beholding from afar off. This is page 217. Beholding from afar off, I saw a great cloud looming black over the whole earth, which had absorbed the earth and covered my soul. And then I think we can do two of these together here because they're pretty much the same thing. Over to 220. Because the waters had come in even under her, wherefore they were putrefied and corrupted before the face of the lower hell, the shadow of death, for a tempest hath overwhelmed me. Well, obviously, the first reaction we get from the unconscious is a storm, which tells us that the result of a Sophia experience is a depression. Just look at a couple of the phrases she talks about. On 218, the second paragraph, go down 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines. The substances must be tormented. A little further down, it gave rise to unexpectedly intense suffering and a perception of his own darkness. See where I am, page 218. Go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines up from the bottom.
Oh, from the bottom.
Yeah, first was down and out, now I'm going up because it's closer. Let's see, it's just nothing terribly new here, just so you can hear some of the language that she uses. About the middle of 220, we're dealing with a negredo. You can see it there italicized and at the middle of the page. The negredo is the darkness, and the alchemical process starts with the darkness. Over to 221, the first sentence of the second paragraph. The encounter with the sublime figure of the anima, which sent the author into an ecstasy and also gave him an inflation, was followed by the enantiodromia, and now the shadow has been contemplated. Page 221, the first sentence of the second paragraph. And you can see that here you have a little clue, the meaning of storm dreams. Not all, but some. And what is very interesting, and I thought we could just take a slight detour here, is storm dreams often are symbolic of war. Which leads to an interesting question. What's the relationship between our personal storms and war?
Much,
you say?
I said, no, not much.
I think there is.
Oh, you think there are?
Uh-huh.
There
is? Yeah.
What's going happening in with the inside is not manifested on the outside?
Well,
I believe, like, to me, just that the more you deal with that, the, you know, the opposites or the wars within, wouldn't eventually, if all of us are doing that, it would start to manifest on the outside?
Yeah, if we are dealing with our own storms, mm-hmm. it would. But my thought is, how much war is the externalization of all the storms we don't go through?
Ah, playing it out.
Playing it out. Yeah. And I brought along a couple of dreams, which I'll read you, which I think are really amazing, from this book, The Reluctant Prophet. And these are dreams of a Jewish rabbi. And I think they were dreamt around 1859. First, this is not a storm dream, but I'll show you what's in his unconscious in 1873. This is about 5 years ago. I saw myself standing in a dream. I saw myself in a dream standing on a high mountain in Romania. He's a Romanian Jew. In a dream standing on a high mountain in Romania, persuading the Jews that they should not nourish any false hopes that by the aid of the Alliance Israelite or by the aid of the big European powers they would achieve equality. They should rather go to Palestine, settle there, and take up agriculture. And then shortly after that, he dreamt this, which you can see the war is in his unconscious. At another time, I saw in the east, in the proximity of Romania, a terrible thunderstorm. See, this is this. And from there, a mass of threatening dark clouds move all around to most of the European states. But it came to Germany earlier than Austro-Hungary. Isn't that amazing? 1873. This struck me very much. Continuing dreaming, I thought the meaning of this is that the Romanian spirit of hostility against the Jews will make its rounds in other states, but it will strike roots first in Germany before it grips other countries. This whole book is like that. But just to give you an idea how, again, there's this parallelism, I think, between the inner work and the outer work. And there was in the unconscious the war as a storm. 60 years before. The other thing that she mentions in light of the black cloud in the storm, I'd like to look at, and it's a little difficult. I hope I can make it clear to you. We may need to go slowly. I think I'll read it and then I'll explain it. But it goes a little bit to what asked the question about. Don't mystics.
Don't they portend?
Don't they portend? And I think sometimes they do, but here's a mystic. I don't know him, but I looked him up. Hugo of St. Victor, medieval mystic, born 1096, died 1141. And just to give us, again, an idea how the Sophia experience contrasts with religious thinking. So she writes the bottom of 218. I'll go through it, and then I'll try to explain it. But I'll have to go slowly because it's a little hard to grasp. I found it. The state. Go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines up. The state is the darkness. As several other authors, including Hugh of St. Victor, who described his overshadowing by the unconscious very beautifully as the imagination gaining power over the light of reason. But now we have to understand what he means by imagination. He says that this imagination is nothing other than an image of the body. So you see, this is in the area of Sophia. This is these body experiences working through his perception of it. That this imagination is nothing other than an image of the body perceived from outside by the senses and then conducted inside to the pure part of the corporeal spirit, the vital spirit, and impressed upon it. I think that would be the mind. That's what they mean there. The anima rationalis, that would be the rational soul, and I believe by that they mean the mind. The anima rationalis, he says, is an incorporeal light. But the imagination, being an image of the body, is a shadow. So the idea is that the imagination is fired by the desires of the body and makes an impression on the mind. That's what I get so far.
Let's do it again.
If I've got him right so far, the body's desires activate our imagination, imagination that is fired from desire, and that makes an impact on our minds, and that's what he's calling understanding. When therefore the imagination ascends to reason like a shadow, which approaches the light and overwhelms the light, if the imagination becomes manifest and is more sharply outlined, but only if it approaches the light. Now, but I understand, your desirousness affects your imagination. Your imagination, which is fired by those desires, speaks to your mind. You become aware of the fantasies you've had through desirousness. And then in doing that, you get to know your desirousness. And in the text he says the shadow is more sharply outlined.
What did you say his years were?
1096 to 1141. So about a little bit earlier than Thomas.
1096.
Now hold that thought, because what he's going to do is he's going to contrast knowledge of the imagination with knowledge of God. Now we're going to see how that relates to Sophia and see the difference.
Okay, so this is when God influences reason from above.
Yeah, but that's like part two.
Oh, okay.
He's saying there are two types of knowledge. There's the knowledge which occurs when your imagination speaks to you. And there's a knowledge when when God speaks to you. That's what he's saying.
Because I kind of see the God in imagination as...
Yeah, that's what we're going to come to.
Oh, okay.
But she's trying to get us to realize how different this Sophia stuff is from traditional medieval theology.
Gotcha. Okay, I'm looking
up. Okay. Again, you might say, well, I'm not medieval, but be careful. You might find just how medieval you are. So that's call that knowledge one. Knowledge two. Oh, I'm going to go a little bit. The imagination becomes manifest and is more sharply outlined, but it only approaches the light. If it overwhelms the light, it overshadows it and covers it up. The result is an affectio imaginara, by which the soul is affected through its contact with the body. In other words, you don't want that stuff to get too strong, or it'll blow out your light. Now, another type of knowledge, when God influences reason from above. See, this was from below. Below meaning from desirousness. When God influences reason from above, wisdom arises. When the imagination influences it from below, it produces scientia, which is knowledge. So he is making a distinction between knowledge and wisdom. And to be as simple as I can, knowledge is the awareness of your physical self communicated to you by your imagination. So it's desirousness, to put it very simply as I understand this. That's knowledge. Wisdom is another type of knowing. It's when God addresses that light. So you see the distinction between light and dark, even in a mystic. Wisdom is from God, knowledge is from the earth. Now, let's compare that with Sophia. That's the next paragraph. In the process described in Aurora, however, the influences from above and below coincide. See, that's the big difference here. We are no longer looking at a higher knowledge and a lower knowledge. We are no longer distinguishing knowledge and wisdom. This is the big change. The descent of wisdom to the adept is followed by an extinction of consciousness. Well, that we've seen in the storm. This is why she's talking about it. A darkening of the light, a state of complete disorientation and depression. But what did we see in the earlier chapter? But that the darkness is the light. See the difference? That's when the darkness is the light, then you don't make this distinction between above and below. And there is no distinction between wisdom and knowledge, or if you prefer, faith and reason. That's the difference, and that's why I wanted to go into it, between the medieval mind, the medieval level of consciousness, which has got two categories, and Sophia, which is trying to create one type of knowing.
Are you saying that reason is Sophia?
Sophia would be wisdom / knowledge, which is known through several faculties. Reason, feeling. Why I think this is so important, we're trying to break down compartments. That's why I went into this. I think why she went into it. Maybe by recognizing the contrast with medieval thinking, you get a better sense of what level of consciousness we're trying to birth in the Sophia material.
You know, it seems to me this is an essential piece, because you have to differentiate before you can create, you have to see the
right
differentiation before you can come back to
right
that wholeness. So, I mean, I just think this is phenomenal that they could even be having this conversation, because self-reflection only started a few hundred years earlier.
Yeah.
If he could reflect this deeply, mm-hmm, this
well, no, he did. This is, he did reflect. This is
Victor.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, sorry. Yes, yes, yes. Right.
In the 12th century.
Right.
Having these kind of thoughts is
right
pretty profound.
Yeah.
Because he was
right
doing the differentiation that we were going to later come back to see as one.
As it's one, right. And that, by the way, is Jung's, going back to this ion stuff, why he felt that the Christian millennium had to be the way it was, that there had to be a differentiation, which was the necessary historical task at the time, but now our task is the synthesis, which is you get in the two fish and the one water carrier. Yeah. Yeah. He's not knocking the Christian worldview for its time. He never does that. But he's saying we need to reevaluate where we stand vis-a-vis it now. Tom, did you want to read that quote from Mysterium?
The one about the dark cloud, but what you just mentioned here is also
presaged in the previous paragraphs, and I think it's important to mention a couple of those, especially about the view the good and evil are spiritual forces outside us, and that man is caught in a conflict between them is more bearable by far than the insight that the opposites are ineradicable and indispensable preconditions of all psychic life, so much so that life itself is guilt. Even a life dedicated to God is still lived by an ego, which speaks of an ego and asserts an ego in God's despite, which does not instantly merge itself with God, but reserves for itself a freedom and a will which it sets up outside God and against Him. Well, how can it do this against the overwhelming might of God? Only through self-assertion, which is as sure of its free will as Lucifer. And he comes down and says that the state of things would be insupportable if there were nothing to set against evil but the law and the Decalogue, until the Reformer and Rabbi Jesus tried to introduce the more advanced and psychologically more correct view that not fidelity to the law, but love and kindness are the antithesis of evil. Then he quotes from this power of the earth in Ephesians 2:2, so that the youth easily entered in through the pores and instantly shaketh the foundations of the earth and raiseth up a dark cloud. In the description of that, he says, the earthquake sent up a dark cloud, colon, consciousness, because of the revolution of its former standpoint, is shrouded in darkness, just as the earth was at Christ's death, which was followed by the resurrection. The image tells us that the widening of consciousness is at first upheaval and darkness, then a broadening out of man to the whole man, and man being in quotes, he calls it the anthropos.
Yeah, that's, I love that quote.
Oh,
that
the, that really blew me away.
What page is that, or paragraph is that?
The paragraph, the first one starts at 206. It's a mysterium, tumultuous. That last thing about the earthquake is paragraph 209.
What page?
It's paragraph 209, it's page 171.
Read that bit again, just that sentence.
The image tells us that.
Yeah.
This image of the cloud tells us that the widening of consciousness, widening, broadening of consciousness, is at first upheaval and darkness, then a broadening out of man to the whole man.
So you see, you've got earthquake, you've got cloud, you've got storm. These are all those beginning images of the process. And beginning often takes you a while, at least in the analytic setting, to get there, or to have the strength and the courage to face, to let that storm rage, or to let go of the old presuppositions.
On the storms also, when we're going in that spiral or whatever, you revisit, you can go through a storm of one aspect of your life,
absolutely.
And then go through another, then go through all the phases, and then go down to a storm in another aspect, so it's like...
Definitely. It's a spiral. Same ideas expressed on 223. She is referring to the waters that inundate the top of the page. The waters, which according to the text penetrate to even the lower hell, symbolize a loosening of the personality structure or a dissociation. The feeling of guilt, however, is due not only to the author's having been overwhelmed by the shadow and by pagan fantasies. Does that make sense, Parish? So that's all the desire that hits him. Which has been taught is bad.
Right, now what about, and then we're getting into that inflation. See, I have this whole
but thing. Also to the previous inflation, right. The inflation is as much an inundation as is the depression, but the inflation feels good and the depression feels bad.
But psychically they're equivalent?
Psychically they're equivalent. One, you're being identified with your light, and the other case you're being identified with your dark.
Like euphoria and dysphoria?
Euphoria and dysphoria. The contamination of the psyche with the super personal contents of the collective unconscious brought about by the encounter with wisdom. So here we're talking about wisdom as beginning in this difficult emotional experience. I damage the personality by producing an impure mixture of earth reality or consciousness of reality and see collective unconscious. That would be either the inflation or the depression.
Gary, does this make sense of it this way? So when I read that, what I hear happened to him is that he saw through the myth that was structuring the world in which he was living. And in that moment of the depression, it was that period at which he pierced through that myth and could no longer adapt back to it. There was no adapting back, and he came through it. Then once you see through the myth, it's followed by a period of inflation because you think how there's a sense of awesomeness that you somehow have this special power, special way of living in the world that sees beyond the myth that everybody else is living. Does that make sense?
Not quite.
That's not
it's close. I would put it like this. He got zapped by an emotion. And I'm guessing from knowing him and from the phenomenology of his material that it was sexual or erotic. And he himself had no awareness of what it was really saying. Or why it was saying it to him, or where what it had to contribute to our understanding of the evolution of the history of through the evolution of the form that Christianity takes. It's just he was just stoned on an affect, and out of that affect, out of that euphoric mood, he had this desire to talk about it and communicate it, and that was the inflation we saw at the beginning. But I would never say that he saw any deeper truth. He just got caught by this feeling. And now the experience won't be finished until he does get that understanding, which says he's never going to get. But we'll see what the psyche starts to do to give him that understanding. And then that's what we're trying to do with people who get seized in a similar way, either by an inner, by the way an outer situation touches their desire or negative feeling, or to what looks like an outer catastrophe that has apparently thwarted their previous plans. But I would always leave you with this idea that the Sophia is about an emotion without the understanding.
And I could draw footnotes too to help us on our own journey.
Once you know this as a roadmap,
right,
it's a very great help.
I'm saying it's easy to project out and sit it out, but then start integrating it.
And that's personally why I study it, because it's a great help for me to know these paradigms when you're working with somebody who's cooking.
And then in your own life, too.
Not to mention my impression life.
So cooking is sort of the slow, steady heat is the standard aspect of the process, but then an emotion, an affect occurs, and it sort of bubbles up and spills over, and then you try to put it all back in the pot,
yeah,
figure out what caused that, keep that either from happening again, or try to understand why it happened again.
See, there's no slow, steady heat here.
That's just it. The
emotion there's a wildfire that's cracked his vessel.
Okay, yeah.
And he can't barely contain it, and I think it killed him.
Blowing the head from
the... Yeah, but I mean, the whole thing together was just an overwhelming experience that he couldn't come to grips with.
Yeah. Well, think about it.
If he'd ever gotten laid, he never probably would have written this.
You're probably right.
The insight I had, I don't know.
Say that.
Well, it does show you, in a way, he is a cosmic victim.
Victim?
Yeah, I mean, he at least to my thinking, you know, the celibate life is hardly desirable. And so he chose this spiritual path, lived it to the best of his ability, and I'm sure for a while suffered. He must have been lonely. Who could he talk to? I think he had one real good friend. And then he gets this experience, which is really even stronger. And the reason he got it was because he was so committed to the religious system, which was inadequate. But by being committed to it, he gives us a voice of how it can change. So that's the story. That's so important.
So he never does.
Well, you know, it's been a while since I read this thing. I would say not in our terms of understanding.
Okay.
No, he didn't. And
well, that's kind of the warning, though, of getting stuck there, then, right? Of getting.
Yeah, one of the things I hope we'll see out of this work is this convergence between personal suffering and, I don't know quite how to put it, community giving. He had a personal problem, I'll make a 20th century, 21st century value judgment. I think he had a personal problem, and he was celibate. I consider celibacy a problem. I've worked with any number of priests, and every one, they cannot deal with this sexual issue, and they're out the door. I mean, it's tragic to see. The most recent one out the door, and the next thing I heard, he was dying. His body, you just can't do that to a human being anymore. Give up sex, I'm sorry. So that's called a personal problem. That's admittedly a value judgment. But he didn't just have this sexual problem. All of Christianity has an instinctual problem. And his personal problem was a microcosm of the macrocosm of Christianity. So that what we also try to do in helping people work through their own personal problems is help them see what in the society is the analog to their own personal problem. And by working on their own personal problem, they often will connect up with the outer parallel to their inner problem in their work or their vocation or their volunteer work and begin to contribute to that. So we help people get through a personal transformation, and we help them make that meaningful by connecting them with the outer situation that needs to grow generally like they need it to grow specifically and to give it meaning. So two things we can get out of this hopefully is, what's this process look like so we don't get stuck in it? And then how do we take our own pain and put it in a broader perspective? That to me is what the collective unconscious is about. And anybody who goes through a deep analysis will come to that. That they turn back to the world and help move it along at the point where they were stuck. But then see, that's the way back to life, living authentically as who you are. Because you're not some great yuppie driving an SUV on a cell phone. You're a suffering human being who knows what it's like to struggle with something, and you see other people struggling, and you reach out and you make that connection. And the next image that comes along is on page 222. So we go from storm to the next image, which is, strangely enough, not uncommon in dreams. The Ethiopian. You wouldn't think, where in the, why in the world do people dream of Ethiopians? But they do. I have. I'll tell you about it. Then before me shall the Ethiopians fall down, and my enemies shall lick my earth. Therefore, there is no health in my flesh, and all my bones are troubled before the face of my iniquity. So the key image there is Ethiopian. Let's just concentrate on that for a little bit. Again, you might think it's so obscure, but I promise you, it's not that uncommon of a dream. And I, you know, you can't explain that from personal experience. Why would anyone dream of Ethiopians? But it's an archetype. Interestingly, Ethiopian, I looked this up, comes from the Greek aitho, which is to burn. And I guess OPS, I'm not sure whether it's pronounced OPS or OPS, meaning face. So I thought I'd tell you my first dream in therapy, in analysis, which was a woman was brought to me, a Japanese woman, with third degree burns all over her body. And my therapist said, have you ever done LSD? I said, yeah. She said, a lot? I said, yeah. She said, that's what LSD does to the soul. It burns it. It's too much light, too fast. About a year later, I dreamt that I was to be Gustav Mahler's personal secretary. But before he would hire me, he wanted to see whether I could get along with his daughter. And his daughter was an Ethiopian. Now, what I understood of that first part was that, the Ethiopian is the burnt face of the first woman. And that Ethiopian in us is the side that has been burnt too much by consciousness. That when we don't allow the anima, her own role in shaping our life, and we try to control our life with consciousness, we are in effect burning her. And so her darkness then will be the darkness that we need to redeem in order to find our way. And in my case, I took Mahler, I worked in that dream forever until I'm still not sure I totally understand it, but Mahler in German means painter. Painter. Malen is the verb to paint. And at this time, see, I was in my training and I was going to learn to work with images. So I understood that working for Mahler would be working with images. But before I could do that, it had to be ascertained whether I was willing to accept my own darkness. And that was the Ethiopian. And that darkness is tantamount to the side of us that consciousness has run over in its arrogance of willpower, really. So here the Ethiopians occur, and I think they would be another image of the darkness that he has to deal with. Whereas the storm, you see, is a pretty unmanageable darkness. The Ethiopians are not such an unmanageable darkness. And apparently, I did a little research here. The phrase, "And before me shall the Ethiopians fall down, and my enemies shall lick my earth," is a reference to Psalm 72, verse 9. May his foes bow down before him and his enemies lick the dust. So the idea there is that it's an invasion. And the presence of the Ethiopians here is mitigated a bit by the text, But their real phenomenology is about an invasion. In other words, you are attacked by your darkness. So it's a repeat of that storm in another image and slightly more manageable.
Which psalm is
that? 72, verse 9.
Okay, now would that go out? I mean, I'm jumping ahead.
Yeah.
She talks about the Sophia, that's why becoming a servant to Sophia or whatever in these next pages where you're given the linen, fine linen and purple.
Yeah. But you see, before you get the linen, you got to deal with the Ethiopian.
Right. Yeah, I understand.
That's what we don't like, dealing with that stuff.
Here.
Yeah.
Would the Ethiopian have anything to do with the Black Madonna?
Absolutely. Yeah. Definitely. See, the problem with Christendom is that Madonna is white. And the Black Madonna, it's been a while since I've dug into that stuff, Sandy, but I'm pretty sure that mythologically there's a link between the Black Madonna and Isis. Mm-hmm. Isis being black, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Kali and Hecate.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and of course, the Ethiopia we think of as a country, and I think originally was an area, and not the same as Egypt, but also not separate from Egypt. So from that Egyptian world, which of course was considered taboo by the Jews and then passed on in a way to us, this whole dark realm represents what we've ignored, but what we have to reincorporate.
And then in doing as far as integrating the dark, being attacked by your own darkness,
Exactly. When this Sophia hits you, you can figure it. Now let's interpret this to personal experience that you have either been assaulted by a strong charge of erotic desire. And I think depending on your age, it varies the character of that erotic desire. But let's say basically lust. Or you've been put in a situation where you are suddenly filled with revenge desires, or you've been wronged or something like that. So either a very positive emotion or a very negative emotion. And or I think it could be an objective. This could also hit you in an objective misfortune, a car accident. I didn't mention it to you last time, but as I thought about it, you'll never see this person. The woman whose dream we talked about last time, she had been raped, and so she was recovering from rape. Something like that, where life. It's what I call the life's baseball bat experiences. You just get bashed, and so you're revved up with this probably externally looking situation, but an internally problematic state. And then, of course, that's generally when people come to therapy. Not always, but one of the reasons is things have gotten too hot. You know, I can't stand my job, I can't stand my spouse, or I can't stop thinking about my neighbor, or something like that. And so what we would do is then help the person understand what they're going through is okay. You know, it is, there'll be a moral reaction that it's wrong, but if we can explain to them, look, that sort of reaction is based on this idea that spirit is good and instinct is bad. Don't be afraid of this thing. Let's see if we can symbolize it. Well, as soon as they start taking that experience seriously, they're going to get whoppingly depressed. Now, that may take 6 months. It may take a year or even longer. But that's what we're looking at, the roadmap of the various stages that you're going to be going through. And eventually that state of charged up is going to lead to a depression. And you can then say to yourself, okay, we're on target here. You don't have to be afraid. You can see that here is a course of transformation, and this can be a guide through that process. And sure enough, the images you'll start having are storms. You could very well, in my case, I mean, I went to Zurich, and I began looking at myself. I got upset with what a creep I was, and I got depressed. And that was the Ethiopians. Interestingly, in the dream, the end of the dream was she was very beautiful, and I was determined to let her know I saw that. See how the dream compensates. Who thinks that depression is beautiful? But in a way, to learn this process, it is integral that you can allow that ego position to subside so this other stuff can come up. So as far as the unconscious is concerned, you may be miserable, but it says, oh, this is beautiful. Let's see, what else can we do? Do you have any questions, or do you want to try to squeeze in one more point? Okay. Oh, let's see what we can get done here. This is not too much. Actually, it's kind of complicated, but we'll get started. For this cause, I have labored day and night, page 223. With crying, my jaws are become hoarse. Who is the man that liveth, knowing and understanding? Now comes the key phrase, delivering my soul from the hand of hell. I always try to pick out one or two images that are really key in these passages to try to keep us on track. So we have the idea of a soul that needs deliverance. They that explain me shall have eternal life, and to him I will give to eat of the tree of life which is in paradise, and to sit with me on the throne of my kingdom. Page 24, consider these two texts in tandem.
Who's speaking?
Well, it's not clear.
Yeah, I know. What do you think?
Sometimes it's Thomas.
I know, and sometimes it's...
And sometimes it's wisdom, and sometimes it's the misery. Here it's the misery, I think.
God.
You see, that's the nature of somebody who's swamped by the unconscious.
See, the second sentence there sounds like he thinks he's God.
What do you mean that?
That explain me shall have eternal life.
Oh, yeah. Well, that she's going to interpret that as the misery speaking.
Begging.
That the misery knows that it's more than misery.
Yeah. Begging itself to understand.
To be understood.
Either way. Yeah.
So, see, what that means to us, we'll look at this in detail, but just we just have a minute or two left to touch on your question. What the depression is asking of us, is to understand it. What do? We tranquilize it. But the depression itself has a message. And what we try to do in therapy, let's say, is calm the person and say, look, don't you feel miserable, but that's normal. Don't freak out. But you may need to, and here you have to sometimes be very practical, you may need to drop out of your clubs for this year. You may need to, if you can, work part-time. But don't feel that you're being victimized. Understand that you've entered into a transformation process which is going to make demands of you, and offer you something in return. And that's what something we get out of this passage. See, it's hard when you are submerged like this in a difficult emotional state. You say to yourself, one naturally says to oneself, well, I feel bad. But what is really the case is, now, bad is, that's not the right word. Let me say, I feel miserable, because I don't want to make a value judgment. I feel miserable. But what you don't realize is that the miserableness is a person in you with very distinct requests, which you are being asked to hear. Not only distinct requests, but distinct gifts. So it would actually be more accurate to say, I came home and I found Mr. Misery living in my living room, and now I have to be a good host and find out how to have a relationship with this Mr. Misery. That would be a more accurate way to express it. And that's what this text breaks down, a very diffuse emotional experience, which is sometimes this, sometimes this, sometimes this, into its various pieces, and lets us personify them to understand their meaning. I think that's another value of this alchemical, and this is why Jung studied alchemy, to get this stuff clear. Well, I think we'll pick up again. We'll pick up, I'll reread you quotes on page 222 and 223, and we'll just go through how she interprets the distress, how she interprets the fire implication, and how she interprets the garment. But the trick is mentally being able to put yourself into what seem like moods, but realize they are people. And then not only look at that person from your point of view, but try to imagine you're that person looking at yourself from its point of view. This is how we begin to establish a relationship. So she's not going to try to see, what is that misery asking? And what of intelligence is there in it, which we need to extract to move this process on the way, so you can come to the new personality that this emotion is asking you to achieve. Does that make sense? I told you it's going to get a little more difficult. That's about what we do. Okay. Let's see, I think how'd you go up to 230? You're right, Mary. We didn't get to 231. we may, yeah, let's say if you read 231 to... I think you could read to the end of chapter 6. You probably won't get that far, but you'll be a little bit ahead. It's about 10 pages, 12 pages. Yeah, I'm good for about 2 pages at a sitting. Oh. Yeah, don't be shocked. Right, yeah. Don't be shocked if you get confused. You have to read it very slowly. Yeah, you have to read very slowly. It's very, 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 very dense. Okay, thank you, and I'll see you in 2 minutes.